This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
The outcomes for today, what I hope I'm going to sort of impart is, number one, I want to sort of talk about resilience so that when you leave here and other people you know are talking about resilience, you can say, you know, resilience is a word that gets thrown around a whole lot. It's a hot topic. And here's how some of the aging experts in the country are thinking about it and using it and why it changes with time and it matters for your health. I also want to give you sort of two examples of categories of questions that are driving a lot of the work that I'm doing at Duke with a large team of people at Duke. And then I want to hear your questions. So I'll share with you sort of the questions that are driving us and some sneak peeks of the answers that we're getting along those lines. And then I'd love to hear your questions. All right, I often start out, I'm a geriatrician, so I often start out my presentations with a patient case. Today, what I thought I would start with is instead a family anecdote, because it really sort of encompasses a lot of what we're going to sort of hear about resilience. So this is my dad and my two sons, and that picture was about 9 years ago. So my dad and my mom retired from where I grew up on a farm in Arkansas, and they moved to a new farm in North Carolina so that they could be closer to me and my family. And we said that my dad traded in his work title for a new title of MVG, which was Most Valuable Grandparent, because he leaned into this role. He loved teaching these boys to horseback ride, to fish, and he also carted them around to every practice, game, performance, everything that they did. This was just what he loved doing. In this picture, he's about 72 and they're 8 and 10. They look like twins, but they're not. And on one day, because they spent so much time together, right about when this picture was taken, they all got a GI virus. So on the same day, they all had the same GI virus. So we've all had it. We know the misery, 6 to 8 hours of absolute sick as a dog. And then you get better, and it's just kind of a matter of rehydrating and recovery. So I did what I often did on the day after all of this had happened, and then the next day they were sort of back into it by that evening. And after work, I left work about 6 or 6:30 and met my dad, where he had one of the kids, at a baseball field for baseball practice. And I crawled up into the stands next to him, and the kids are out there playing baseball. And I look at my dad, and my dad, who is this robust guy in his early 70s, horseback riding every day, running kids around, you know, looked like kind of uncharacteristically peaked, like sort of just, you know, a little tired. He's had a water bottle with him. He was, you know, and I said, Dad, are you still sick? Like, you could have called in sick. You didn't have to take the kids to baseball today. Are you okay? And he said, I'm fine. He said, you know, but I will tell you, in this 98-degree North Carolina summer, watching those kids, watching Chris run around those bases like nothing ever happened yesterday, it just lets me know I don't bounce back like I used to. And I think that story says so much about resilience and what it's all about. Because on the one hand, even though he's a healthy guy, he's nobody's definition of frail or, you know, many people would say he looks younger than his age. But when you get stressed, when something hits you, it's just that not quite bouncing back. And he made a full recovery. You know, it wasn't like the GI virus took him out. But it just was a little bit slower, took a little bit more of a toll on him. And that's kind of the classic thing about age-related changes in resilience. But a couple other things about the story that I think are really important is that he was actually demonstrating some great resilience in certain domains. You know, he was using humor to kind of get through it. He was doing what my mom always used to tell us when we were kids. In this family, you inherited a suck it up gene, and I expect you to express it. And, you know, so he's doing a little bit of like, all right, I'm just going to show some grit and some efficacy and power through it because I want to be here. And I think that what we see, too, is that sometimes there are age related changes in that variety of resilience that the data would say go in the positive direction. So whereas physically his resilience is maybe not what it was when he was a teenager, you know, the suck it up gene is strong. And so this kind of gets at, you know, resilience is a hot topic right now in aging research. This is me and my friend Peter Abadir, who's at Johns Hopkins. We were very honored to get to co-chair this conference that was held, that was the National Institute on Aging, bringing together a lot of sort of thought leaders and people who study resilience in health, because kind of what the National Institute on Aging was saying was, you guys are all turning in grants using the word resilience, and you're kind of using it in different ways. So can you come together, sit in a hotel conference room for a little while, and like get your act together about what's resilience and how do you define it? And we sort of acknowledge that there really are, you know, there are people who mostly study physical health, there are people who mostly study cognitive health, and there are people who mostly study psychological or psychosocial health. And we were all using resilience because it resonates with all of us, but we were all using it just a little bit differently. And the other nice thing about sitting in a room with each other was we all also realized that it's really arbitrary to break these into different domains because they are all part of our health, right? So how well we're doing and how well we're functioning and what we can do really is kind of all these things. And so we tried to come away with what we called sort of a cosmopolitan appreciation of resilience. And rather than saying this group saying it right or this group saying it wrong, we sort of said, look, fundamentally, we all kind of agree that we've all developed our own sort of frameworks and tools for measuring and definitions. But at its core, it has something to do with entailing a positive or adaptive response to a stressor. And the stressor is important here. Just like I used to tell my kids, you can't be brave unless you're afraid. being brave doesn't mean you're not afraid of something. It means you're afraid and you do it anyway. Being resilient implies that there's some sort of a stressor. There's something that you're overcoming. So we all kind of agreed that that's part of the root of our definition. And then beyond that, we all sort of agreed to respect each other in the different sort of frameworks and tools and ways that we've hashed out to think about it. And so I personally, because I'm a medical doctor and it's just the training that I've had and the questions that have always driven me, are sort of about physical resilience to a biological stressor, health stressor. So that's what I'm going to talk about here. But I want to just acknowledge, and you'll hear throughout the talk, elements that rise up of how also psychological resilience is really important and comes into play. Cognitive resilience is a big part of what I do in sort of this biological resilience frame. So I want to just first sort of ground us all that, you know, these words sometimes get used slightly differently, but they're all important. They're all part of health. Okay, so because I said I mostly think about sort of physical, biological health and resilience, I understand everything in human health as this kind of constant balancing act that our body is doing to try to remain at equilibrium or homeostasis. That is health. And that all of us sort of are a complex dynamic system. Now, there's a whole science built around studying complex dynamic systems, which might be the economy, which might be society. Multiple, you know, certain machines are complex dynamic systems, but the human body is a classic complex dynamic system because what defines a complex dynamic system is that it's a system made up of multiple subsystems that all talk to each other and are trying to keep the entire big system at this sort of state of equilibrium or stability. And what we see that in a human, those little subsystems, we could divide them into your organ systems. Within the organs, there are tissues that work together as a system. Within those, there are cells. And inside the cells, there's these subcellular and molecular organisms, right? But what's important is that all of this, if something perturbs some part of the system, other parts of the system have feed forward and feedback mechanisms that sort of try to get the whole system back at a steady state, right? And a lot of how I understand sort of problems with health, states of unhealth, is generally when that system is not at a steady state. So the system is constantly dealing with just small perturbations, like getting a little bit dehydrated or changing in temperature, things like that. And everything is kind of trying to keep you at your set points. Keep your body temperature the same, keep your blood pressure the same, keep your heart rate the same, despite these little kind of challenges that we're throwing its way. And then sometimes what happens is a bigger challenge comes its way. So an actual disease. So all of resilience is this sort of mechanisms that we have in place to sort of withstand these challenges. And we really think of disease or injury as a substantial stress to that system. And then it becomes a vicious cycle. This is the vicious cycle of aging. So what we know is that that system, just even if you're very lucky and you dodge cancer or heart disease or a major autoimmune illness, even if you're very lucky and don't have one of those diseases, all of our bodies are, as time passes, undergoing small detriments to that system's ability to robustly, quickly adapt and change to perturbations. Now, if you get a diagnosis or a disease, you sort of take a big hit to the system. Now the system has much less resilience just to deal with those little tiny daily perturbations, and it puts you at risk of the next condition. So this is sort of the vicious cycle of multiple chronic conditions that can occur. And then the thing is, too, that all of this has this molecular basis. So within every one of you, in every cell in your body, there are fundamental biological processes going on at the molecular and cellular level that are critical to health and your cell's ability to respond to these little stressors, whether it's a change in temperature, a change in the amount of a nutrient that's available, lack of nutrients, or physical damage. These are sort of the systems, and you've already sort of heard about some of them, right? So mobility energizing stores, what do you need for that? Mitochondria. You need healthy mitochondria that are working in order to mobilize energy when you need it in a time of stress or crisis. So all of these sort of biological systems are fundamentally important to the whole person being able to respond to stressors that come along. And that's a lot of what you're going to hear in the next keynote talk. My friend, Dr. John Newman, is going to talk about some sort of the trying to re-engineer, if you will, the biology at the fundamental level to re-engineer a more youthful biology, which in theory should make all of the cells better able to respond and be resilient to any disease or threat that comes their way. That's the sort of holy grail. That's what we're all sort of aiming toward now, is to understand the biological aging process well enough that we can, to borrow a word that sometimes seems a little goofy, hack it, to be able to hack the biology and make it more youthful, more the way that the reason that a 10-year-old can get a GI virus and the next day run around the baseball field like nothing happened. All right, so when we get into this, it's really important to realize that the pace of this biological aging, so as I said, every single one of us has these processes going on in our cells, responding to little perturbations all the time, and every single one of us is aging. We started aging when we drew our first breath. Aging is not something that happens after 65. Aging is happening across the lifespan. We're all aging, but we're not aging at the same pace. And that's a critical thing that, this is two of my colleagues at Duke, Moffitt and Caspi, Avshalom Caspi and Terry Moffitt, who happen to be a married couple, but also both incredible scientists. And one of the projects that they have done for 30 years is they have done the Dunedin Project. So this is named for Dunedin, New Zealand, which is a city in New Zealand where 50-something years ago, they enrolled almost every single baby that was born in this small town in New Zealand between 1972 and 1973. They have 1,000 people, and they've been following them since that time. So it's one of the largest and most deeply phenotyped birth cohorts in the world now. What you're looking at here is photos. Each one of those photos is actually 10 faces. So it's a computer amalgam of 10 faces to protect the identity of the real people. But those are each face represents 10 faces of the people from Dunedin taken when they were 38 years old. Now remember, it's a birth cohort. They were all born the same year. They're 38 years old. But what you can see, I think, is that some of the faces look younger than 38. And some of the faces look older than 38. And the way they selected which 10 to put together was based on a tool that Moffitt and Caspi have developed out of the Dunedin cohort that is called the pace of aging measure. So what they did was they took these people between ages 28 and 38, they measured 18 things that we can measure that are things like their gingival health, their gums. How healthy were their gums? They measured over that period of time things like how long could they stand on one foot? How many seconds? Things like that. These are things that even in a 28 to a 38-year-old, getting worse, and they looked at not how much what they were at 38, but the pace, the slope. How quickly were they changing between age 28 and 38? They put all these together with fancy statistics and came up with one number. Using that number, they selected the 10 women and the 10 men who had the best number, 10 that had the worst, 10 right in the meaty middle of the normal curve, and looked at their faces. And it's shocking, right? Like, we can see it in the phenotype, but this is saying that the underlying sort of mapped onto that very perfectly. Now, interestingly, this is, we've heard about Brian Johnson. Brian Johnson is one of the enthusiasts of the longevity craze. And he has something that anybody here happen to be on the leaderboard of the Rejuvenation Olympics. So you can actually go to this website, Rejuvenation Olympics, and you can, I think it's that you spit in a cup and send it in. And they've now taken that Dunedin pace of aging measure and they've mapped it onto an epigenetic tool. So again, you can get a single number, a score, that tells you what your pace of aging is. And what it comes out as is like, so he, right on the day that I took this snapshot from the leaderboard, he's not always number one, but he's usually in the top 10. And this was, on that day, he was number one. And his pace of aging is shown as 0.54. So what he's claiming is that his, for every one chronological year that he ages, he's biologically aging only 0.54 years. So now, many people have disputed whether it really works like that. But the thing that I think is pretty interesting and cool here is that he's using, I mean, this is like this big, people from around the world are sending their spit in and having their pace of aging measure, and they're using the Dunedin pace of aging, which is actually built on really strong science and bears out and is cool stuff. So I love the fact that this is, you know, generating interest. People want to know their number. The Dunedin study also has now done it with a brain MRI. So with one single structural brain MRI, they can analyze it in a certain way and they get the pace of aging of the brain. All right. So, and as I said, that tool was built on people aged 28 to 38. But what we see is that by late life, the patients that I take care of as a geriatrician, we can start to see wide discrepancies, right, in people's biological aging. So these are two men that are both 72. And you can certainly imagine that if I'm a surgeon and I'm looking at taking these folks to surgery, I have a pretty good guess which one I think is maybe a better surgical candidate and likely to recover better, even though they're the same chronological age, right? But sometimes people really surprise us. So think about two different patients evaluated the same day, same clinic, nearly the same chronological age. They're both considering a knee replacement surgery. She is 76. She's a caregiver for her husband who has late stage Parkinson's disease. Her main motivation for having this knee replaced is she wants to be able to take better care of him. But she lives a mostly sedentary life, has a lot of chronic illness, has undergone some other surgeries in the past, but it's been a while since she went under the knife. Next patient, 75-year-old man, wants a knee replacement because he loves to play tennis and golf. He wants to get back to the game. He's got a great wife and daughters nearby that, you know, are kind of his support system. We could all imagine that if I told you these two people, they're now going to go to the OR on the same day, get their knee replaced. One of them is going to have the course like B, where everybody after they get their knee replaced has a few days where their function is poor and they have to lay around in bed. But one of them's going to completely recover, get back to how he was before, or maybe even better. And the other one is going to have that knee replacement, and it's going to be complication after complication, wound infection, delirium, problems, you know. And the family will always say, if we had only known how that was going to go, we never would have let them have that surgery, right? And most of us would probably take a guess, if I told you this is what's going to happen, that probably the man is going to get B, and that woman is the one who's going to have C. But what we kind of realized when we were thinking about this in the Duke Pepper Center, which is where we study a lot of this resilience, is that sometimes we get that wrong. And we mostly get it right, But there's these outlier cases where somebody you thought was going to do great didn't do so great, or the opposite. Somebody that you really, you know, were recommending, don't do the aggressive chemo, don't do the surgery, don't do. And then they did, and you know, they did great. So the questions that are kind of driving us are, why is it that there are patients that can look kind of similar even sometimes, experience a very similar health stressor, and they just do so differently? Can we get better at predicting so that we can give better advice to people? And then can we leverage what we learn about who does well, who doesn't, and who surprises us to be able to try to turn that into a drug or an intervention and optimize bouncing back for everybody? So this is sort of just the framework that I'm showing that you that we use when we design our studies. And we've now applied this framework to multiple patient populations. And what we always try to do is measure something in each of the boxes to be able to sort of set up our statistics. We try to understand what are the sort of chronic factors that a person has, you know, underlying all this. We try to measure some measures of reserve, what we call reserve, before the stressor. So how's their cognitive health, their psychological health, and their physical health before we stress them? Then we look at a stressor. And again, we've done this in different kinds of paradigms of stressors. We measure something about the stressor to try to get a size of the magnitude, because not all surgeries are created equal. Some are bigger stressors than others. And then we follow them over time. So we're trying to basically map out through repeated measures of health how they did, and see if, and then we also know that that typically correlates to long-term outcomes like survival and health. So I'm just going to give you kind of one example of the way that we've kind of tried to capture or measure resilience. Sometimes we measure it just by looking at the trajectory itself. Other times we do this thing called the expected recovery differential, where we take a big group of people that have all been exposed to the same stressor, and we use data that we had from at the beginning, like their functional status, what comorbidities they had, how well they rated their self-rated health, depression scores, things like that. And we put that all into a statistic model, and we predict how this person should be doing at 6 months based on everybody's data. And then we look at how they actually did. And that difference becomes what we call their recovery differential. So most people don't have a big differential because most people do exactly how we predict they would do. But what we're looking for is those outliers, those people who were a lot more resilient or a lot less resilient than we would have thought that they would be. So we're kind of asking the question, how much better or worse did this person do than I thought they were going to do? This is just a proof of concept study. We took a big database like this of people who had had hip fractures. So the only thing these people had in common was they had all had a hip fracture. And we had a blood draw right when they came in to the ER with their acute hip fracture. We picked out a couple of these, you know, as I said, these biological processes that everybody agrees, these were ones that we thought, okay, we have some measures that we could get from this blood that sort of map on to a few domains of biological process that we think would be especially important to your recovery from a hip fracture. We measured those in the blood. And then it turned out that that panel of biomarkers, knowing nothing else about these people, predicted almost 40% of the variability and how people did, which for people who study biomarkers, that's huge, because a lot of times how people do in health has a lot to do with a lot of other stuff, like their desire to get better and what chronic conditions and what medicines they're on and stuff. But so the fact that just the biomarkers predicted almost 40% of this variability was huge, and it all went with exactly what we would have hypothesized. So those people who did a lot better than we thought they would, they tended to have very low cellular senescence. Cellular senescence is something you might hear about later today, but one of the features of aging. They tended to have low markers of inflammation. They were not chronically inflamed people. They had high mitochondrial function, big, strong mitochondria, and they had high levels of other cellular metabolism. And then the people who didn't do so well had the opposite. So then, based partly on that, we set up a new study of people that were coming in for an elective surgery. Now, the reason we did an elective surgery was the problem with doing it in a hip fracture. You can't plan your hip fracture. Nobody plans to have a hip fracture tomorrow. So we don't have measures of them before. So we did this kind of experimental test where the nice thing about an elective surgery is it's kind of like a big stressor, but people are planning to do it. So we had an opportunity to meet with those people in the 2 weeks before their surgery and collect a lot of information. So we collected a lot of information about their cognitive health, their physical health. We put them through the paces with these things called provocative tests, where we're actually stressing them a little bit. You know, we're saying we want to know how well you're going to hold up to this big real world stressor of a surgery. We're going to actually stress you a little bit and see how you do with a little stressor and see if that will help us predict. Then during the surgery, we measured a lot of stuff. And then for 1, 2, 4, and 6 months after, we measured a bunch of stuff again. So I just want to say a shout out to these participants. 203 people over 60 planning a major surgery took the time and the effort to come in and let us measure hundreds of pieces of data on them from multiple data points. And without them, we would not know the things that we're about to learn from this study. So shout out to people who participate in research. Also shout out there, sorry, to my friend and colleague, Kathleen Colonna-Marie, who's the co-PI of this study with me, and is an absolute pleasure to work with. So these are kind of the provocative tests that we did. We did dual task gait speed testing, where you look at the difference between if you make somebody just walk and then if you make them walk and do math problems or do cognitive problems at the same time. Now, when we're stressed and having to think and do cognitive stuff, everybody slows down a little bit. But the people who slow down more, sometimes that can show me something. It can be they actually tell you in geriatrics, a pearl I learned was if you're walking somebody to the room and you start talking, oh, how was your trip, blah, blah, if they have to stop to answer the question, can sometimes be an early sign of problems. Okay, the another one we did was this near-infrared spectroscopy, where you can see me doing it to somebody here, where she's got some wide wires hooked up on her forehead, and what I'm looking at is her cerebral vascular reactivity as I'm about to make her do an orthostatic challenge, stand up, and see how quickly her brain reoxygenates, and also do some cognitive and math problems. And then the other thing we do is something with a white blood cell response. So we wanted to know how your immune system responds to things like viruses and LPS toxins, but I didn't really want to take these nice people who were about to undergo surgery and give them influenza. So what we did instead was we drew their blood into a tube, we took their white blood cells, and we gave the white blood cells influenza, and we gave the white blood cells LPS toxin, and then we measured what those white blood cells did about it. We measured, as I said, a lot of measures of reserve before the surgery. And this is just a sneak peek of the data. We are going through this data now, and it is weekly meetings that are so much fun to sort of meet and see every week what we're learning from these folks. But this is just showing you the basic kind of when we plot out how they did, and we ask the statistics to tell us, you know, find different patterns in the data and sort people into the pattern that most closely resembles their experience. And what you can see is about 46% of the cohort, whether in the other case it was 43% of the cohort, but 40-ish percent of the cohort didn't do so hot. And this is in one way we're measuring how did their reports of pain interference do over time. And the other one, we're looking at step counts measured with like a Garmin or a step count monitor. And what you can see, though, in both of these that I think is pretty telling is that when we just look at this, one of the best predictors of which group you're going to be in is where you started. So in every case, the people who did the best were people whose measures even before the surgery tended to be on the high side. And then over here, what's really interesting is when we look at pain, how much are people reporting that knee pain is interfering with their ability to be able to do stuff? The people who didn't do so well, and I will say it all got better. You know, they were all reporting less pain after the surgery than they were reporting before, and that's good. But there's still pretty high pain in this red group up here. The main thing that predicted you being in that group was depression scores. So, and they had high pain before. Pain got a little better with surgery, but maybe not better enough. And that might suggest that some of their pain might have had something to do with stuff other than their knee. But again, that's important for us to know. Because if we had kind of known that and appreciated it before, I wish we hadn't put them through a knee surgery. We gave them a lot of pain to go through surgery to only get a little bit better 6 months later. So that's some of the stuff we're trying to learn. Getting better at predicting recovery trajectories. Getting, ultimately, what are the current interventions that we can do to bolster everybody's recovery. And then, and this is just a teaser for the next talk that you'll hear later today, this idea of resilience in a pill. And I'm not showing you any of that data yet, partly because we're still working on it. But the idea that are there druggable targets from these molecular measures that we might be able to give people a pill and give everybody a better shot, a better recovery? All right, I'm just going to quickly go through, because another big set of questions that's driving me right now is applying all of this to the aging brain. So another job that I have is I am the co-director of the Duke UNC Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, and we are really applying all of this work that I've done in sort of aging and how resilience changes with age to the disease of Alzheimer's. And it's fascinating. So my questions there, are there age-related changes in resilience that sort of drive the onset or progression of Alzheimer's disease? And can we identify specific biological or exposure-related, stress-related factors that could help us take a more precision medicine approach to Alzheimer's? Because I think it's pretty clear at this point that, yes, there's genetic propensity for Alzheimer's, but it's not all genes. It's a clear, complex gene versus environment disease. And what causes Alzheimer's in one person may not be the same things that caused Alzheimer's in another person. So just a quick kind of backup to give you a sense of Alzheimer's, just to make sure we're all on the same page. So the classic features of Alzheimer's that define the disease are having amyloid and tau in the brain. In this artist's rendition, the big gumball-looking things, the big brown fuzzy things, that's amyloid sitting outside the nerve cells. The blue stuff inside the nerve cells, that's tau. Now, both amyloid and tau are normal proteins in your body. You have them all the time. In Alzheimer's disease, they start to become misfolded or misphosphorylated, and they cause real problems. And this is the classic thing of Alzheimer's. But the thing that we know now that we didn't know for the first 75 years we were trying to treat Alzheimer's was that actually these changes have been happening in the brain years and sometimes decades before the first memory and cognitive problems surface. So a lot of my work now is really trying to understand, by the time amyloid does appear, we also think, even though the amyloid appears, then the tau, cognitive problems happen some point later, by the time high levels of amyloid are there, my feeling is something has already broken down years to decades before that allowed the amyloid to start to accumulate. And if we, by the time the amyloid's there and detectable in high levels, for many people, we may be too late. I really want to get to a point where we understand what are the signatures, what are the problems, what's happening before the amyloid. So what we're doing in the Duke UNC Alzheimer's Disease Center is following this framework, which is that we know that some of your risk for Alzheimer's disease is inherited when you're born. It's your genes, the environment you're born into. And yet, unlike most genetic diseases, most people live 7-8 decades before they manifest the disease. That's a weird genetic disease. So there's a lot that happens between birth and manifestation of this disease, and that's what we're going after, is this opportunities in the middle that are untapped opportunities to prevent this disease really kind of before it takes hold. So this is very different. We're the only Alzheimer's Disease Center that is focused solely mostly on people who don't have Alzheimer's disease, which is weird to be an Alzheimer's disease research center that enrolls people who don't have Alzheimer's. Most other centers have enrolled older adults expressing symptoms or high-risk, rare variant families, and most of them have been very educated, high socioeconomic status, mostly European ancestry. We're trying to do something different, which is to sort of fill this evidence gap, enroll people that are younger. We start following people annually at age 45. So we enroll people who have a known APOE4 gene, the main genetic risk factor for Alzheimer's, or a family history of classic late onset Alzheimer's dementia. But we're enrolling them at age 45. They're much more rural. They reflect where I live in North Carolina. And we collect data on lots of brain relevant things. So we're looking at how their eyes, their retina's changing. We're looking at MRI, we're looking at PET scans. They give us cerebrospinal fluid, blood tests. We do tests of vision, hearing, olfaction, lots of tests, and they come see us every year. So our main cohort includes 420 people. We'll enroll our 420th next month. We're 95% complete right now. Up to 100 can have symptoms when they come to us, but no more than that. The rest have to be asymptomatic when they walk in the door. And we're following them over time. It's also, as I said, we are a high need area. So the incidence of Alzheimer's disease is known to be linked to sort of the poverty and deprivation of the county, the census block. This is data from one of our scholars in the center, and he did national data, and you can see where we are in North Carolina, very high rates in these eastern communities. And a lot of people, we don't really understand why. So one of the things that we've done too, and I'm just gonna tell this study because there's a UCSD piece of it, we are contributing data to the Alzheimer's Gut Microbiome Project from one of the communities where the star is right there. That's Robeson County, North Carolina. It's the reddest of the red in North Carolina, with the red being deprived areas or poverty-stricken areas. It is the tribal seat of the Lumbee population, which is a tribe in North Carolina. It's 50,000 members strong. So it's the largest tribe east of the Mississippi River. High, high rates of dementia and lots of other medical conditions. And there had been no research in this population. This is, we take this truck and go out. That's one of the tribal headquarters. Our truck's parked in front of it. That's inside that truck. So inside that truck, there's basically a little nurse clinic visit. And the gentleman's there getting his blood drawn. That was the scene across the street. So if you're standing by the truck and looking across the street, and then we're collecting blood samples, stool samples, and the stool sample data gets analyzed here at UCSD, because this is a partnership between Duke and UCSD for this big sort of international study. And UCSD is a major leader in microbiome research and understanding the gut-brain axis. So I'll just wrap up here by saying, you know, I think trying to understand how biological aging and age-related changes in resilience affect our brains is more important now than ever, because as it says here, our brains have been aging for millennia. People have been having brains, but we live longer and we are stressing them through middle life in ways that we never have before. So I think it's really important. This is data from our cohort, that cohort of 420 people. This is scary, folks. What you don't want to be is down here on the bottom part of this, because this is brain amyloid. Being lower on this means higher brain amyloid. It means you have less in your cerebrospinal fluid, which means you have more in your brain. And what we're already seeing by age 45 is that the APOE4 carriers, even though their values aren't, for many of them, the values aren't yet abnormal, they're accumulating more quickly by age 45. Amyloid is depositing in their brain and accumulating. That means 45 to 60 is our window. We got to get in there. We got to figure out what's happening and what's causing these people to start to accumulate the amyloid. I thought we'd just end with the happy news. There is also a lot known about things that we can all be doing, whether you have an APOE4 gene or a family history or not, things we can all be doing to protect our brain. You've already heard about some of them. Data evidence now behind physical activity. And in the studies, it was 150 minutes a week. It's kind of a lot of, you know, getting your heart rate up, physical activity. Mediterranean-style diet, low in processed foods, controlling your blood pressure and blood sugar through middle life, linked to better cognitive outcomes later. Don't ignore vision and hearing loss. Data that addressing those helps protect your brain. Social and cognitive stimulation, making sure you're getting adequate sleep, avoiding traumatic brain injury like helmets and seatbelts, careful on the ice, you don't really have that here, and then avoiding toxins. All right, and I just like to say thank you to the entire team. The work that I presented today, obviously it takes many, many scientists to pull together this work, as well as philanthropists and participants. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Dr. Whitson, for that fantastic talk. So we'll be collecting cards now for the Q&A, but we'll go ahead and get started. I really liked that you ended your talk on that positive note of things we should be thinking about in order to protect our aging brains. Let's kick it off with, what have you seen are the best measures of resilience?
Yeah, so some of that depends on what kind of resilience you're trying to measure. As I said, I really like those measures that ask that question of, how much better is this person doing than we thought that they were going to do. I like that because what I'm trying to get is after I've sort of controlled for, adjusted for a lot of the things that I can't really control in the person's, like how many chronic conditions they already have or medicines they're already on or how old they are. The problem with measuring it that way is I have to have data from a large sample in order to come up with that measure. So I think that the other kinds of best global measures of just how well am I doing, it sounds super simple, but sometimes it is the sort of simple and global things that are very helpful. So self-rated health is a great one. If you're following just along, how does a person tell you they feel like their health is? Patient-reported self-rated health correlates really well. And so if somebody has a stressor and I'm trying to follow them for six months to know are they better or not, sometimes the person is the best source of that information. If I'm going to measure something, gait speed is something that we go to a lot. It's a general kind of measure of just overall, how are you doing? There's lots of reasons that a person could be walking slowly versus walking. And this is when we tell people, walk at your usual comfortable pace. If people's pace is slowed down, it's kind of a catch-all for a lot of things being potentially wrong.
Great. Okay, we have a lot of questions here. Would you please give more info on the APOE gene? Is there a test that we can take to see if we have it, and do you recommend it?
Great question. Yes, there is a test. You can do like 23andMe or those kind of I don't know if Ancestry has it, but a lot of people show up in my clinic because they say, I took one of these tests, I did the medical genetics piece, I found out I have this gene, what should I do? So yes, you can get it. The answer of should you get it, that's more complicated. Because the truth is right now there is nothing evidence-based that I can do that I wouldn't tell you to do otherwise. Whether you have the gene or not, I'm going to tell you to do all those things on my last slide, and you should be doing all those things on my last slide. So having the gene, not everybody who has the gene gets Alzheimer's. Not everybody who doesn't have the gene doesn't get Alzheimer's. So it's not it's not the end all be all. The other thing that you need to know is that if you get that information about yourself, you're getting that information about your children too. They now know that they're at risk for the gene. So anytime you do genetic testing, you just kind of have to have a conversation with other people because you're now getting information that has bearing on them and their health, and they might not want to know.
Okay, I have a two-part question. The first part is, so who did do better in the knee surgery? Inquiring minds want to know. The next question that adds on to that is, do you envision a future tool where an individual can quantifiably map their recovery and their trajectory prior to certain surgeries?
Yes. So as far as those two examples were given, and they are both sort of modified enough to protect the people's identity. Those were not real pictures of the real people, but they were both made off of real people, and they actually did the opposite. So they sort of fueled the questions because we had a person who was a very young, in his 70s, had never had surgery before, did not do well with this surgery, and it surprised the heck out of all of us. And then the woman, a caregiver for her husband, who we kind of were really worried about her as a surgical candidate, did great. And so it was kind of a question like that that fueled a lot of this interest. And in terms of, yes, what we do hope is that there would be, and we actually have a prototype clinic of this now at Duke and at the Durham VA that's called the POSH Clinic, or the Perioperative Optimization of Senior Health. And people come to this clinic. At the time that you go see the anesthesiologist before your surgery, you also see a geriatrician. For anybody who's over 80 or has other sort of risk factors that are age-related, they see the geriatrician and they get a lot of information and a lot of sort of an evidence-based, personalized sort of recommendation. And very rarely, they'll meet with the surgery team and suggest that we delay the surgery until we can optimize the person's health a bit more. It's rare, though. Most people proceed with their surgery but do a few things to try to be more optimized.
Okay, this is going to be our last question. Why is plant-based diet not more studied or recommended?
Oh, that's a good question. So I recommend, you mean Mediterranean as opposed to just a full plant-based?
Yes.
So I would say that I think it is being studied, at least where I live, part of the reason it's not more recommended is that if I told my pig-eaten North Carolina patients to go plant-based, I might as well tell the wall. I mean, honestly, that's part of it. And so I think that, like, you know, some of it is just the culture, and food is culture. I mean, you're absolutely right that for a lot of people, and I think a lot of times a lot of clinicians struggle with, I struggle myself. I mean, I always say I stand up here like, you know, I exercise and work out a lot. I keep it all a little bit more insulated than I wish I did. Like, you know, but I feel like I always tell people, do what I say, not what I do necessarily. I like ice cream a lot. You know, and so I think that's an important piece of resilience and health too, is that we want to be healthy to be able to do the things that we love and keep us happy and keep us motivated. I want to be just healthy and fit enough to be able to do all the things I want to do. And I don't want to eat absolutely clean all the time, every day, obviously, you know. But what I try to do is educate myself so I understand the trade-offs and the choices that I'm making. But I actually think that that's an important part of resilience too, is that we don't want to make ourselves miserable in the pursuit of being healthy, because that's not healthy.
What about alcohol?
Yeah, somebody asked alcohol. You have one of the world leaders in Dr. Moore. I don't know if you knew that, but Dr. Moore here at UCSD is one of the world leaders in sort of alcohol use as we age. So I'm almost afraid to answer it in front of her, but what I would say is that there's mixed data. Is that fair to say? Mixed data. There used to be sort of a prevailing thought that, like, one a day was good for you, and I think that's kind of fallen out of favor. Most people now would believe that little good for your molecules comes out of alcohol. But food is culture and social, and there are sort of, for some people, it is part of events and social events. In moderation, in that context, there may be sort of some benefits, but probably less. Less is more. And I more often see where it's a problem. So I'd be careful. Is that a fair answer, Allison?
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Dr. Whitson, for that fabulous keynote talk.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.